Let me start by thanking the organizers for their kind invitation. It's always a really great pleasure to be back here at PI, in particular for what promises to be a really inspiring workshop. So what I'll be putting forward is an asymptotically safe point of view on the gravitational path integral. And I'll be explaining what that point of view entails. And towards the end, I'll be in particular focusing on the potential sort of benefits of an asymptotically safe point of view in terms of predictions that one can make. So what we are trying to make sense of here is the gravitational path integral. And one of the questions that I would like to raise is, what is the microscopic action that we should actually be putting into this path integral? So of course, the Einstein-Hilbert action is the sort of canonical starting point that one would choose. And then perhaps just proceed with a perturbative quantization, just perturbing the metric around a flat background, expanding in fluctuations, and thereby just arriving at a perturbative quantum field theory of a spin 2 field on a flat background. Now, of course, that program runs into problems because of the negative mass dimension of the Newton coupling. One needs to introduce counter terms going two orders higher in derivatives at each loop order. So at one loop already R squared and R mu nu squared, and at two loop the infamous Skorov-Sagnotti counter term, which is just the Weyl tensor cubed. And that pattern is expected to persist. And what that means is that at every loop order, one has to introduce new couplings in front of these counter terms, and there is no way of predicting the values of these couplings from the model. So one has a bunch of new free parameters at every loop order. And of course, taking this to arbitrary high loop order will then result in an infinite number of free parameters and therefore in a breakdown of predictivity. And so therefore, maybe the Einstein-Hilbert action is not the action that we should have started out with in the gravitational path integral from the beginning. The question then is there at all a consistent choice of the microscopic dynamics so that we'll arrive at a quantum field theory of gravity, at a path integral description of fluctuations of all metric? Is there at all such a choice that will give us a finite number of free parameters? And I'll be advocating asymptotic safety as a potential way of arriving at such a choice. So let me just briefly comment some more on the Einstein-Hilbert action. Of course, from a classical point of view, these are just the leading terms in a curvature expansion. And as long as in gravity we are mostly probing the dynamics in the weak field regime, now of course the gravitational waves have opened a new window into the strong field regime, but so far most observational tests actually focus on the weak field regime, then it's just expected that we see these two terms as the dynamics of gravity, but it's actually observationally really hard to say whether there are higher order curvature terms in gravity or not. So actually, from an observational point of view, even in classical gravity, we don't really know that much about potential higher order terms. And then, of course, from a quantum field theoretic point of view, quantum fluctuations generically generate terms beyond Einstein-Hilbert in any case. So the perturbative counter terms tell you exactly that. It's a generation of additional terms in the dynamics from quantum fluctuations. And if you want to think about another well-known example, then the Euler-Heisenberg action in QED, where fermionic fluctuations generate higher order photon-self interactions, that is another well-known example. So in general, the dynamics for gravity is just living in an infinite dimensional space of all couplings that are compatible with diffeomorphism invariants. Now, of course, this can also have the potential benefit that adding these higher order curvature terms can potentially cure some of the problems that we have with the Einstein-Hilbert section, Einstein-Hilbert action, such as potentially cure the conformal factor instability. But the main question that I want to focus on here is this question of when we are living in this infinite dimensional space of couplings, how do we end up at the setting which just has a finite number of free parameters? So how do we end up at a setting that is predictive? And what I would like to explain here is that predictivity is actually linked to the requirement of having a fundamental theory. A fundamental theory, by that I mean something in contrast to an effective theory. So an effective theory is one that holds over a finite range of scales but needs to be supplemented by new physics somewhere beyond. A fundamental theory, if you think of this path integral from a sort of lattice-like point of view, where you introduce a discretization just to regularize the path integral, then a fundamental theory is one where you can consistently take the continuum limit and that path integral still makes sense. So you can take the cutoff to infinity. From a more physical point of view, if fundamental theory is one which doesn't require any new physics at any scale, so where the degrees of freedom that you have put into this path integral really makes sense up to arbitrary high energies, and there isn't any scale at which new degrees of freedom show up. And so what I will be explaining here is this link between between the existence of a fundamental theory, so the continuum, being able to take the continuum limit, this link to predictivity. And that is basically one of the things that asymptotic safety tries to do. So in order to make sense of this, let's think about the fact that quantum fluctuations in general drive a running of the couplings as a function of the momentum scale, and that you can think of as a sort of cutoff scale or typical scale at which you consider your dynamics. Now, a fundamental theory is one where we can take that momentum scale to infinity and really understand the dynamics at arbitrary small scales. Now, a predictive theory is one that has a finite number of free parameters in this infinite dimensional theory space. And at first glance, it's maybe not particularly obvious that these two things should have anything to do with each other. Now, let's think about some sort of generic point in the space of couplings. Then if you follow the renormalization group flow from this point, and if you sort of reverse it and go towards higher scales, go towards the UV, then starting from a generic point, you will typically run into something like a Landau pole type problem. So that means that you will not be able to take the continuum limit. You will generically see divergences in your running couplings. Beyond perturbation theory, this is simply the triviality problem, which means that if you insist on being able to take the continuum limit, then your renormalization group flow drives your couplings to zero in the infrared, and thereby you end up with a non-interacting, a trivial theory. And so this is the case for a generic point in theory space. Starting from there at some finite scale, you will generally not be able to take a continuum limit. Also, such a point is in general, of course, not predictive, because in order to specify it, you actually need to specify an infinite list for the values of all the couplings at your initial scale. Now, all of this changes if you think about renormalization group fixed points. So these are points where the scale dependence vanishes. And so if you approach that point as you go towards higher scales, you can spend sort of an infinite amount of RG time very, very close to that point. You're just entering an effectively scale invariant regime. And therefore, at such a point, you can then take your momentum cutoff to infinity. So you can actually take the continuum limit, and you thereby define a fundamental theory. Now, on the other hand, let's now think about predictivity. And the key point is that starting from such a fixed point, in general, the renormalization group flow takes you out along trajectories which lie in the so-called UV critical surface. So that surface is spanned by the relevant couplings. The relevant couplings, you can think of those as just encoding the deviation from scale invariance. So this renormalization group fixed point gives you a scale invariant microscopic regime. As you go towards larger scales, smaller momentum, you deviate from scale invariance along one of those trajectories, and then the values of the couplings in the critical surface just tell you how far you have deviated from scale invariance. The key point is that you can't just flow out into other directions. The flow is always confined to this purple hypersurface, and thereby the dynamics at all scales is actually determined completely in terms of these relevant couplings that just give you the coordinates on the critical hypersurface. In particular, in this simple three-dimensional sketch of the infinite dimensional space, what you can see here is that it's enough to specify the value of g and lambda at some scale to actually give you the value of this additional coupling sigma. So that does not mean that the value of sigma is zero. It can very well be finite, but it's at all scales predicted as a function of the two relevant couplings. And so therefore, there is actually a connection between these two points, having a fundamental theory and having a predictive theory, because requiring that one is able to take the continuum limit actually enforces infinitely many relations between the couplings in theory space, because it requires one to really lie in the UV critical surface. And this determines the infrared dynamics up to presumably finitely many parameters. Of course, if the critical hypersurface turns out to be infinite dimensional, then there are still infinitely many free parameters. But one can actually generically expect the critical hypersurface to be finite dimensional. And so this means that these two requirements, having a fundamental theory and having a predictive theory, actually turn out to go hand in hand. Let me also, as an aside, mention a question that I have to the sort of discrete folks in the room, which is the following question. If you have a discrete quantum gravity model, where you're saying, well, I'm insisting on there being a physical fundamental cutoff, then I can just define my dynamics to lie anywhere in the space of couplings at my fundamental cutoff scale. And then the question is, how do I at all get that setting to be predictive? So there is no longer any principle that forces me to lie on some special hypersurface in the space of couplings. And generically, it seems that, therefore, models which have a fundamental physical cutoff might have problems with predictivity. So this is maybe something that we can discuss at some point. Yes?
Sorry, so in the case you're discussing, why again do you expect it's a finite-dimensional?
I'll be talking more about that a little later. But in general, if you're looking at the origin of theory space, then that surface is just spanned by operators which have positive and vanishing mass dimension. And if you move away from that, then you get an anomalous contribution from quantum fluctuations. But in general, you can expect that contribution to be some finite number. And that means that it will be just a finite number of irrelevant operators that will be shifted into relevance. So I'll be talking more about this in a few seconds. So if that doesn't clarify, then just ask again. OK, so let's close the bracket on the question for the discrete models. And let's go back to the renormalization group fixed points. And let me quickly contrast asymptotic freedom, so that's a renormalization group fixed point here in the origin, to the case of asymptotic safety. So from the point of view of high energy physics, asymptotic safety, which is a fixed point at the finite value of the couplings, that sometimes seems a little more exotic, because in high energy physics, we're actually very much used to the case of asymptotic freedom, as, for instance, part of the non-abelian gauge theories in the standard model. However, from the point of view of statistical physics, interacting fixed points actually encode universal scaling behavior in the vicinity of continuous phase transitions. And therefore, from the point of view of statistical physics, quantum field theories which have interacting fixed points are actually the norm, not the exception. So asymptotic safety isn't actually such an exotic thing to occur in quantum field theories. There are actually lots of examples in statistical physics. And here I'm arguing that maybe we should take that concept from statistical physics and think more about it in high energy physics. OK, so let me contrast these two fixed points. So asymptotic freedom is simply the fixed point in the origin of the space of couplings. And that means that the scaling behavior of couplings is simply determined by the canonical dimension. So those couplings are relevant which have positive canonical mass dimension. And then there's a bunch of couplings which are canonically dimensionless, but which are made marginally relevant by quantum fluctuations. And this includes the non-abelian gauge couplings. So this means that, for instance, in QCD, the theory is asymptotically free. And then the departure from scale invariance is parameterized fully in terms of the value of the QCD coupling at all scales. Now, the irrelevant couplings, those that I can predict, then include those with negative canonical mass dimension. And note that that doesn't mean that those couplings are actually vanishing. So for instance, in QCD, in the low energy confining and chiral symmetry breaking regime, field strength to the four operators actually play an important role. But the key point is that there is no independent coupling associated to that. You can calculate the value of that coupling in terms of the one free parameter of QCD, namely in terms of the QCD coupling. There is also a bunch of marginally irrelevant couplings. Those include canonically dimensionless couplings, which are made irrelevant by quantum fluctuations. And one famous example is the abelian gauge coupling, which actually means that if you insist on QED being defined at the free fixed point, then you will actually get out a theory that remains non-interacting, trivial, all the way down to the infrared. Physically, that simply means that QED actually needs new degrees of freedom at some high energy scale. So it's not a fundamental model. OK, now let's talk about gravity. So the Newton coupling has negative mass dimension, which actually means that if you want to define the continuum limit at the asymptotically free fixed point, then you will get out that the Newton coupling actually goes to zero in the infrared. So you have a non-interacting gravity theory, and that's clearly in contradiction to observations. So now let's talk about asymptotic safety. So that's an interacting fixed point. which means that at the fixed point, you will have residual interactions. And so quantum fluctuations will contribute to the scaling of couplings. And so the relevant couplings, they are determined by a combination of canonical and anomalous scaling dimensions, such that this combination is positive. In contrast, so the same is actually true for the irrelevant couplings. It's also a combination of canonical and anomalous scaling dimension that has to be negative. And what that actually means is that if you look at canonically irrelevant couplings, they can become relevant at an interacting fixed point and vice versa. So this means that if you're looking at an interacting fixed point, just looking at the canonical dimensions of your couplings doesn't actually tell you which of these couplings are free parameters and which of them are predictable. And that actually means that asymptotic safety, that paradigm, could actually have an enhanced predictive power in contrast to the asymptotically free case. And I'll be coming back to that at the very end of my talk. So let me very briefly say something about the sort of the tools that we need in order to analyze the setting in gravity. So clearly, we need to make sense out of the renormalization group flow in quantum gravity. And that is extremely challenging because it means that we need some form of local coarse graining procedure. So firstly, that means that we actually analyze the Euclidean path integral, not the Lorentzian path integral. And secondly, in order to implement a local coarse graining, we need some background structure that tells us what we mean by locality. And that means that we will use the background field techniques where we split the metric into a background piece and a fluctuation piece. And just very briefly, I will not go into any technical details, but I would just like to mention that this is not perturbation theory, so the amplitude of this fluctuation is not restricted. You can still sum over the complete path integral by summing over all configurations of the fluctuation field, and that just technically means that the renormalization group techniques that we are using are non-perturbative RG techniques. Yes?
Since you've moved over completely to the Euclidean sector, do you expect that the results you get the analysis that you will do have bearing on Lorentzian geometries?
Well, I certainly hope so, but
given that the spaces of geometries are so completely different, sometimes empty for certain manifolds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So certainly, you know, whether the quantum theory of spaces that I'm strictly speaking talking about here, whether that has any relation to the quantum theory of space-time, that's a big open question. And I'm certainly hoping that I will get some inspiration how to answer that question at this workshop. Lorentzian signature and background independence, I think, are the two sort of major technical and conceptual challenges of this approach to quantum gravity.
Why don't you keep the eye?
If you keep the eye, then it becomes very difficult to implement the notion of local coarse graining, simply because if you want to impose a cutoff on the Lorentzian momentum, then it doesn't effectively constrain either energy or spatial momentum. So to effectively impose some form of momentum cutoff, you have to move to the Euclidean case. So it's really just for technical reasons. Obviously, we would like to make sense out of sort of coarse graining in quantum gravity in the Lorentzian case. A wish list that one might have is really to maybe be able to apply other or new techniques to access the path integral in quantum gravity and search for asymptotic safety from a different point of view. Let me just briefly mention also that the renormalization group is becoming more and more of a sort of common language for different quantum gravity approaches. And PI seems to be a particularly fertile ground to think about these ideas, because a lot of the applications of the renormalization group to different quantum gravity models have been done actually here at PI. One thing that I would like to throw out here is that if you think about applying similar tools to causal sets, which is an inherently Lorentzian approach to quantum gravity, then the only form of coarse graining that one can implement is inherently non-local. There is no form of local coarse graining. One can only do a coarse graining in the sense of going from models with many degrees of freedom to models with fewer degrees of freedom. So that's still a physically very reasonable form of coarse graining, but it's completely non-local. And so this is maybe one of the more general questions, whether Lorentzian coarse graining necessarily has to be non-local or not. So let's now get back to the standard Euclidean renormalization group flow for quantum gravity. And let me explain what the hints are that we have for asymptotic safety in the gravitational path integral.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
Suppose you have found this magical point in parameter space by some way. So this is now the Einstein-Hilbert Lagrangian plus all these correction terms. So suppose we know all of these terms. Are you telling us that now if you, I want to calculate something about gravitational waves or the solar system, that I should now use all these higher derivative terms, which are going to qualitatively change the solutions.
So I would expect that in the weak field regime, so solar system tests, you do not have to bother about the higher derivative terms. But of course, one really exciting question is whether in the strong field regime, which is now accessed by binaries of black holes,
take a harmonic oscillator and I add a higher derivative term, this will totally even qualitatively change how the solutions look like.
No, but I mean, if you look at the equations of motion that you get from higher derivative gravity and then put in the fact that you're actually basically around flat space, then the corrections from the higher derivative terms will not matter. They will only contribute if you have finite background curvature. And so therefore, if you are in settings where you're looking at the strong field regime, so where you have large background curvature, there you can actually then expect there to be substantial departures. But not in the weak field regime.
I understand this is the standard viewpoint, but I think this is not necessarily correct because higher derivative terms will always, no matter how small is their coefficient, they can drive you into, you can produce lots of runaway solutions very easily.
Yeah, so stability or unitarity is maybe what you're referring to is and is actually an important question, right? So in general, if you just have sort of arbitrary higher order curvature terms, of course, you can introduce additional instabilities into the system. So one of the requirements for this whole setup to be physically reasonable is that, in fact, something like sort of close to flat space is still a stable solution. So that, or phrased in a different way, that the fixed point that you're getting out of here is actually underlying a unitary theory. And so that does clearly impose a lot of constraints on the space of couplings.
In the usual effective field theory approach, we always consider the possibility that there could be higher dimension operators, right? And those are not usually viewed as...
I understand this is the standard viewpoint.
Okay, so your question, you think it's wrong?
I've heard this a million times.
Okay.
But she wants to have it a fundamental theory.
Why don't you just get your basis point?
Classically, you need the more boundary conditions.
Well, it depends, right? So if you go to a finite order and higher order curvature terms, then generically you need a larger number of initial conditions, or sort of physically you have more propagating degrees of freedom.
Right.
The key point about this setting is that you go to arbitrary high order and the curvature. And then you can, in principle, have solutions where you have a propagator that contains arbitrary higher momentum terms, but that still just propagates a massless graviton. But of course, having this in this infinite dimensional space of couplings does restrict what type of dynamics you can have there. And whether that is realized or not for this fixed point is an important question to check.
But it's I think the word runaways is very important here.
Sorry, the word?
Runaways.
Runaways.
No, these runaways. An old story in electromagnetism.
Exactly, yeah.
With radiation reaction. Yeah. That is not just a matter of adding one more initial condition. You add there was a third derivative, and it really destroyed everything.
Yeah. So classically, I mean, if you stop at a finite number of higher derivatives, you do get an Ostrogradsky instability in gravity. That is not necessarily the case if you go to arbitrary high orders in the curvature, and this is what we are doing here. But maybe this sounds like a really great point for further discussions. So let me highlight the hints that we have for asymptotic safety in gravity. So basically what is being done is that the renormalization group flow is evaluated in typically finite dimensional slices through the space of couplings. One checks whether there is a fixed point, what the relevant directions are, in other words, how many free parameters are there, and then one adds higher order operators to check whether this whole thing converges or not. And of course, one of the important questions here is what gives us control over sort of systematic ways to truncate the space of couplings. The first truncation to start with just includes, of course, the Einstein-Hilbert terms, so running Newton coupling and cosmological constant. And this goes back to work by Martin Reuter in the 90s. And here you can see an ultraviolet fixed point in the RG flow of G and lambda. And you can also see that the critical hypersurface is two-dimensional because you can reach a variety of different values for G and lambda. So we have two free parameters in this truncation so far. Then something interesting happens as you start to add higher order curvature terms. First of all, they are actually non-zero at the fixed point, which tells you that to have asymptotic safety, you do need to go beyond Einstein-Hilbert in gravity. These higher order curvature terms are actually generated by quantum fluctuations. The fixed point persists as we add these terms, and something very interesting happens because two new couplings have been added, but just one new free parameter emerges from those calculations, and the superposition of these two couplings actually becomes irrelevant, in other words, predictable. And that pattern then persists as one goes to higher order in the curvature all the way up to R to the 34. The fixed point always persists under these extensions, and all of these new couplings just correspond to additional irrelevant directions, so no new free parameter. There's just three free parameters in these approximations. And that pattern also persists as one goes to more complicated tensor structures. So the infamous Gorov-Sagnotti counterterm from two-loop perturbation theory turns out to be harmless if one adds it to the Einstein-Hilbert truncation. So the fixed point persists, and this coupling corresponds to an irrelevant operator, which means it can actually be predicted. And you can also see here that there is an ordering principle in the space of couplings that emerges, because the canonical mass dimension of the couplings actually turns out to be a pretty good predictor of whether a coupling is relevant or irrelevant. And so this also goes back to what I was saying in the beginning. We generically expect the critical hypersurface to be finite dimensional, and this is exactly what seems to be the case in these approximations that have been tested. And of course, such an ordering principle, as we see it here, then is something that gives us control over approximations with finitely many couplings. And so I would say that the status of asymptotic safety, if one is being optimistic, is that there are compelling hints for asymptotic safety in pure Euclidean gravity. Now, one of the questions that is keeping me awake at night goes back to the observation that for interacting fixed points, if we add additional fields, quantum fluctuations of additional fields, that in that case, the dynamics at the fixed point and the number of relevant couplings generically change. Sort of the standard paradigm for an interacting fixed point, namely the Wilson-Fisher fixed point in three dimensions for a scalar field, that exhibits precisely this behavior. So if you add a second scalar field that you can physically think of as modeling competing order parameters, then the quantum fluctuations of this additional field change the number of relevant directions. Now, for our universe, we already know that there are additional degrees of freedom present, and gravity isn't everything. So one of the points that I would like to advocate here is that if we want to understand the path integral for gravity, we should really be thinking about the metagravity path integral, even in situations where no on-shell matter is present, because quantum fluctuations of matter can change the gravitational path integral. So let's talk about asymptotic safety in the metagravity path integral. And there's a really intriguing interplay between the metadynamics and the gravity dynamics. And let me first very briefly highlight that there is an impact of matter, of quantum fluctuations of matter on the quantum gravity dynamics. So matter matters. This goes back to work that I did with Roberto a few years ago. And you can show that asymptotic safety appears to pass an important observational consistency test because you can add the meta content of the minimally coupled standard model fields and you still find a gravity fixed point in the Einstein-Hilbert truncation. And what I would like to use the remaining maybe 3 minutes or so for is to highlight some new and intriguing results on the impact of quantum gravity on matter that potentially opens a door towards really testing asymptotic safety without having to go to the Planck scale. And this has to do with the fact that this whole scenario seems to have a very high predictive power for standard model parameters. And this pertains to the marginally irrelevant couplings of the standard model. This includes the abelian gauge coupling, the Higgs quartic coupling, and the Yukawa couplings. So it seems that in asymptotic safety, there is a generic mechanism that could allow us to turn all of these free parameters of the standard model into calculable quantities. And let me briefly explain how the mechanism works. So think of alpha as one of those standard model couplings. The fact that it's marginally irrelevant means that this meta term here comes with a positive sign, leading to a growth of the coupling towards the UV. Now, quantum gravity fluctuations generically give a contribution that is linear in the coupling and where you can think of this eta g as a sort of quantum gravity-induced anomalous dimension. And you can clearly see that if this anomalous dimension from quantum gravity is negative, then you get an interacting fixed point here, so asymptotic safety for that metacoupling. The crucial point about this fixed point is that it's an infrared attractive fixed point. And this means that if you just take a UV interval of couplings, so just look at an interval between alpha 1 and alpha 2, which you define somewhere at some scale KUV, then the presence of this fixed point means that quantum gravity fluctuations drive this interval to a much smaller interval as you go towards the Planck scale. In particular, if you then take your momentum scale KUV to infinity, so really insist on a fundamental theory, this uniquely gives you the prediction that at the Planck scale, the value of that coupling is the fixed point value. So the presence of a quantum gravity-induced infrared attractive fixed point means that you can predict the Planck scale value of that coupling. At the same time, this fixed point also has a second function, which you can see by looking at this plot. So if at the Planck scale the value of that metacoupling were larger than this fixed point value, you can see that you are generically driven into a divergence. And so this fixed point up here simultaneously serves as an upper bound on values of the couplings that you can have for the whole setting to become asymptotically safe. So this is the general mechanism. It works as follows. You will then get testable predictions from the quantum gravity matter interplay in the sense of getting the values of the standard model couplings at the Planck scale. Below the Planck scale, the quantum gravity fluctuations switch off, and you just follow the matter RG flow down to, let's say, the electroweak scale, where you can then compare these predictions to experiment. And so this is sort of one of those renormalization group flows that you then get for the standard model couplings under the impact of quantum gravity in the Einstein-Hilbert truncation. And let me just flash some of the numbers that one can get out of this reasoning. So for the Higgs mass, you obtain a value of very close to the actual observed one. Similarly, for the top mass, and for the U1 hypercharge coupling, this value, which I remind you serves as an upper bound, is approximately 30% above the experimentally observed value. Let me highlight that all of this is very recent work and obtained in simple truncations. What is robust about this setting here is the mechanism that I explained to get predictions for standard model couplings. Whether these numbers are quantitatively precise is something that needs to be checked. Let me also highlight that the same mechanism could be at work in classes of grand unified theories, where it would lead to a prediction of the fine structure constant, as we've put out in a paper last week. So to finish, let me just say that there are very intriguing hints for asymptotic safety in the matter gravity path integral, and that setting could have an enhanced predictive power, actually making this quantum gravity model really testable by looking at the electroweak scale. So stay tuned for the further future developments. And thank you for your attention.
So, let me share a confusion I've always had with this. As originally formulated by Weinberg, asymptotic safety was supposed to be a statement about, say, matrix elements, scattering amplitudes. And so, if I look at, say, 2-to-2 scattering in gravity, and just scale up the momenta by an arbitrary amount, the question is what happens there? Mm-hmm. And I think we at least have some notion of what's going on once we pass the Planck scale, and that is there's basically a non-perturbative breakdown of the theory. Once you pass the Planck scale, if you're going to higher and higher, you know, center mass scattering energies, you're doing something like making a larger and larger black hole. And so the question is how that's sort of accounted for in this story.
So I think what I definitely agree on is that once you reach the Planck scale, you're out of the perturbative regime. Yeah. And so what happens here is that you're then entering this non-perturbative fixed point regime at the finite value of the coupling. And that means that the production cross-section for things like black holes changes from the classical scaling, because in the classical case, you haven't accounted for the scale dependence of the Newton coupling. And so therefore, production cross-sections can be enhanced or can be suppressed because the Planck scale. So what actually happens in the setting is that once you reach what you thought would be the Planck scale, you're in fact reaching a scale invariant regime, and that means that dimensional full quantities will just scale canonically. So the Planck scale just starts to scale with the momentum, and the Planck scale starts running away from you in some sense. And so you never actually necessarily reach that threshold where you would enter into black hole production.
Oh, so you're saying that physically, that it wouldn't happen in a very high energy?
Yeah, so, physically, whether black holes will be produced or not is, you know, something that we can't that at the moment we can't fully answer, but the general argument says that because you're entering the scale invariant regime, you will definitely have a Planck scale that runs away from you. And so this is the standard calculation of the black hole production cross-section that will definitely not apply. Whether the presence of these higher order operators and so on then still leads to some form of black hole production is a question that needs to be answered. But the standard argument in that setting breaks down because you have this non-perturbative running of the Newton coupling.
How do you define a black hole in this regime?
So you would just define a black hole as you would usually do, right? Just by looking at the classical solution and asking whether there's a horizon or not. Right? And you can obviously do that in the presence of higher order curvature couplings as well.
I mean, there are theories known at some level that if you collide single particles, you never create a non-perturbative excitation. But if you collide a coherent wave of many particles, you do produce them. So what you're saying is not unknown in other theories.
Well, but I think many people find it very surprising in this context.
That doesn't surprise me.
But, you know, so
I think there are some theories in which it's possible that by single particle collisions of arbitrary high energy, you do not explore the non-perturbative configurations. That's quite frequent. It's only by colliding. It's only by colliding large coherent, superpositions of many particles that you would excite the.
Well, Born infield is one example.
But maybe we shouldn't carry this discussion too far. But I think there is pretty good reason to believe that you do have that correlation between non-perturbative objects like black holes in the gravitational context.
So I'm not necessarily saying that doesn't happen. I'm just saying that the standard calculation doesn't apply because it doesn't account for the running of the Newton coupling. But then, of course, you know, we are also working in the Euclidean, so you know, taking into account sort of, you know, black hole configurations in the path integral in the Euclidean setting is of course something that is a little bit more challenging. So, you know, as I've highlighted in the beginning, that there might really be new physics that comes in when we look at the asymptotic safety in the Lorentzian case, and that might have very well to do with, you know, black hole configurations being properly accounted for in the path integral.
Also, the dependence on momenta is actually through the momentum transfer, and so when you're performing a high energy collision in the traditional picture of how you form a black hole, actually you're effectively sensitive to the Newton's constant at smaller and smaller momentum transfer, in some sense, because you're, in other words, it's more of an infrared effect. You're forming a big black hole. So
sure, but you know, the presence of the higher order curvature operators might also, you know, change the sort of UV-infrared duality that you have in this setting. So I think there are several things about this setting which alter the analysis in comparison to the standard case.
So I have another question. So since you're interested in the UV fixed point, so at the UV fixed point, the R term, the Einstein-Hilbert term, should be really small compared to that, should be a subdominant term compared to the R squared terms. So why don't you use just the R squared term, I mean, Riemann squared or whatever, as your starting point? Because then the canonical dimension counting, everything is completely different anyhow. So
no, but I mean,
what is... Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a very naive question. It would be helpful if you could explain that.
So in general, you know, whatever sort of starting point you choose for this type of calculation in your space of couplings, unless there is a symmetry principle that protects you from generating all of the additional couplings, you will generate them. So if you look at a truncation with a R squared type of term, then you will generate the Einstein-Hilbert part of the action as well.
If you have R squared, you have four derivatives, and then the metric has dimension zero, right? So then your whole dimension bookkeeping is completely different.
So it might be
canonical
that
dimension mm-hmm. is sort of at the fixed point is completely different from the starting point if you just keep the
yeah. So I think what you're saying is that there might of course be additional fixed points in the space of couplings. For instance, one that you know has to do with sort of just curvature squared type of couplings, which then just has different critical exponents from the one that we are looking at here.
Well, maybe I misunderstood. I thought you had these R squared
yeah, yeah.
as on your critical
yes.
manifold.
Yes, but G and lambda also correspond to relevant couplings. So there, if you put in R squared as a sort of you know seed for the as a propagator for the quantum fluctuations, you generate the Einstein-Hilbert term, and G and lambda both turn out to be relevant parameters.
Yes. But so which coupling constant you are considering? Coupling constant to standard model or gravitational constant or what, mm-hmm. for what you write beta function?
Yeah, so we include the Newton coupling cosmological constant, higher order curvature terms, and then in these works also meta couplings, but all the work in the meta gravity models, that is for a running Newton coupling cosmological constant and standard model couplings.
No,
whereas in the pure gravity case...
Yeah, gravitational mm-hmm. constant, as you know, has dimensions.
Therefore, yes.
mm-hmm. I'm not even sure that you can write beta function equations.
You can. Mm-hmm.
Beta function equation normally exists only when your divergences are logarithmic, and gravitational constant divergence is quadratic.
Mm-hmm.
Like for Higgs mass, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, I do not know how you can write even beta function equations. If you would consider higher order
mm-hmm.
gravity, okay, then R squared gravity, then it would be renormalizable series.
Mm-hmm.
But there is another problem with this series, the existence of ghosts, you know
yeah,
very
sure.
well. So in which class of series, okay, you assume that this kind of beta function considerations are
mm-hmm.
valid?
Well, so I mean, in general, I would say that if you're looking at dimension full couplings, then you should work in a scheme beyond dimensional regularization, which takes into account power law divergences. And so you then also get beta functions for couplings that are not running logarithmically, so that are not dimensionless couplings. And let me also say that you know the case of interacting fixed points in three dimensions, where they play a role for statistical physics, that's always in models where the couplings actually have non-vanishing mass dimensions. So for instance, the Wilson-Fischer fixed point is a fixed point where both the couplings that enter actually have non-vanishing mass dimensions. And you can apply exactly the same type of scheme that we use here to calculate beta functions for those dimensionful couplings. And then you get critical exponents that match very well with the perturbative epsilon expansion, with lattice calculations, and so on.
So normally, mm-hmm. okay, when you integrate equation for beta function, then depending on the order, you are summing up leading logarithm,
mm-hmm.
sub-leading logarithm,
mm-hmm.
whatsoever. Here, when you are integrating equation for
mm-hmm.
beta function, for coupling
mm-hmm.
constant, what kind of terms you are summing?
So it also corresponds to not just logarithmic momentum dependence, but also, so for instance, quadratic.
Right.
Thank you.
Are you done also?
I think so. Yeah.
Okay.